The reading is taken from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, and can be found on page 966 in the Church Bibles. Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 12. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who would be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
Thanks, Helen. I wonder if you could put perhaps your server sheet or something like that in that Matthew chapter 2 passage. We'll be coming back to it quite a bit later on. I wonder if you've ever seen what is one of the most thrilling suspense films of our generation. Just 10 minutes from the end of Jagged Edge, you see a man typing a letter on a piece of paper, and you see one letter being typed. And to anyone who's just walked in off the street, it's hard to know quite what to make of it. It's just an insignificant detail. It probably wouldn't mean anything to you, that one letter. But when you know the storyline, that piece of action is so significant that it sends shivers of terror down the spine of even the most cold-blooded suspense film watcher. And if you're the sort of person like me who tends to take refuge behind the sofa, you'll be diving for cover. This evening we're looking at the story of the three wise men. I guess we're all pretty familiar with it. After all, we've had hundreds, probably thousands of Christmas cards over the years with it printed on. But once we come to study the text, we're going to find that the Christmas cards and some of the carols are not all that accurate. First, there aren't three of them. Matthew doesn't tell us there are three. There may have been 50. I like to think there were 500. Secondly, they're not wise men, or even kings for that matter. Matthew just calls them Magi, some mysterious Eastern astrologer priest. And thirdly, they don't come to the stable, do they? They come to the house. So Matthew's parents, Jesus's parents, sorry, have obviously moved the baby from the stable into a house. He may even be a toddler by now. I'm planning to ask Richard Simkin, our muso here, to write a new Christmas carol with the first line, "We three kings of Orient aren't," for this Christmas. So we're not that familiar with the text. Nor are we that familiar with Matthew's intended meaning. You see, without the storyline so far, it's easy to look at the visit of the Magi and find it hard to know what we really ought to make of them. I mean, they only get 13 verses in the whole of the Bible. They drift into and out of our lives in just a few short sentences. And on the surface, Matthew doesn't appear to give us an enormous amount of help. Should we look at the gifts they bring, like you do at Sunday school, and try to see some significance in the gold for a king and the frankincense for the priest and myrrh for a sacrifice? Should we look at Herod's reaction or the fact that these guys are from the east? Should we concentrate on the teachers of the law, or is the significance God's sovereign control of the planetary system? There's no immediate, clear pointer. Until, that is, we look at the storyline so far. You see, if you were to take the Bible in your hand and hold that Matthew section and look at what has come before, you will see that, well, two-thirds, I suppose, maybe three-quarters of the book, the Bible, that you have in your hands comes before Matthew's Gospel. And what I want us to do this evening is, as it were, to rip out that page which rather falsely divides the Old and the New Testament and go backwards and have a look at one or two of the key themes which Matthew draws on that brings this story that's so familiar and yet so unfamiliar alive to us. So would you turn to Psalm 72 on page 585? Leave the service sheet in Matthew because we will be coming back there. Page 585. This, Psalm 72, is a national prayer for the King of Israel. Once upon a time, our national anthem used to be sung every night at shutdown on BBC. Some families still stand for it on Christmas Day. I wonder if you do. I know one or two who still do, after the Queen's team talk. Some of us have sung the national anthem in between renditions of Football's Coming Home this summer. Others, if we didn't blink at the time we could have sung it, sang it at the Olympics. At its best, our national anthem is a prayer. God save her. Long may she live, our noble queen. May she reign a long time. You may think some of the requests are a little nationalistic, perhaps a touch ambitious, but at its best, it's a prayer. And Psalm 72 is a kind of prayer, or it's a national prayer rather, for Israel. And alongside it, our prayers for our Queen pale into insignificance. The requests here are far more ambitious. It begins with a magnificent request that the King might be a picture of righteous purity. No unfair rules, no selfish decisions, no unjust decrees. Just look at verses 1 and 2. Endow the king with your justice, O God, the royal son with your righteousness. He will judge your people in righteousness, your afflicted ones with justice. Then the mountains will bring prosperity to the people, the hills the fruit of righteousness he will defend, and so on. Now we have to admit that that is a wonderful thing to pray for a ruler, isn't it? I mean, I guess all of us are fed up with stories of corruption, of the lining of pockets, of sleaze, of hypocrisy. Now, I find it, I don't know about you, I find it hard to know whether we'd rather see the tabloids curbed and not allowed to engage in their investigative journalism, or to allow them to go on unhindered, because it's right and proper that these national scandals are exposed. But whatever we make of the exposés, if you're anything like me, you're sick to the back teeth of hearing politicians and bishops and royals urging us to get back to basics, and then reading the next day that they've been found in bed with an actress or somebody else's wife. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a ruler where we knew that every one of the decisions, every move, every past transaction was pure, upright, open to the closest possible scrutiny, so that when the Secrets Act was lifted 40 years later, well, you could look through and you find every single decision was absolutely fair and just. Wouldn't it be great to have a king whose past was free from any blemish, so even the most powerful telephoto lens or the most closely tapped telephone wire would yield no double standard, only purity? Wouldn't it be glorious to have a politician? Wouldn't it be glorious to have a politician whose undisputed priority was to help the poor, the needy, the afflicted? It is a fine prayer for righteous rulers. But verses 5 to 7 take it even further. You see, we pray, long live our noble queen, and we sing, long may she reign over us. But we never go so far as verses 5 to 7. He'll endure as long as the sun, as long as the moon, through all generations. See, the frustration of our world, I guess, is that even when we do find a ruler who we somehow think is pretty good news, well, how long will they last? 50 years maximum? In our political system, maybe 5, 10, possibly. But the Israelite national anthem sees them praying for a king whose reign will endure as long as the sun and the moon, through all generations. And it suggests that a prayer like that, a king like that, a ruler like that, lasting forever, with this kind of righteousness and justice will bring security, stability, prosperity, so that the green shoots of recovery do come. And the feel-good factor isn't elusive. And verse 6, he will be like rain falling on a mown field, showers watering the earth. In his days the righteous will flourish and prosperity will abound till the moon is no more. Then we sing, "Send her victorious," don't we? I'm sorry if you're here from abroad tonight, but we do sing, "Send her victorious." I'm not quite sure why, seeing we've only got 3 men and a dog in our army. But we sing it nonetheless. But look at the psalm in verses 8 to 11. He will rule, this righteous, pure, just king, will rule from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. The desert tribes will bow before him, and his enemies will lick the dust. The kings of Tarshish and of distant shores will bring tribute. The kings of Sheba and Seba will bring him gifts. All kings will bow. All nations will serve. Verse 15, long may he live, may gold from Sheba be given. And so on. So do you see that this is a prayer that the king should reign righteously, should endure endlessly, and rule boundlessly over every nation and every people. There would be one unifying international ruler. And everybody in the whole world will fall flat on their face before him in worship. Now when Janet and I, my wife and I, were engaged, we'd sometimes have supper on the balcony of her flat in Clapham. I don't think we were unusually dull or short of things to talk about, but once or twice we'd see aeroplanes coming in, flying low overhead, and run an imaginary conversation along the lines of where they might be going. Somewhere exotic, the Bahamas. Wouldn't that be wonderful? A winter break. Somewhere exciting, Florence. Just imagine the art galleries. Somewhere dramatic, the Alps. Wouldn't that be fine? 6 months later, a particularly perceptive friend of ours heard us talking like this, and I thought rather unkindly pointed out that Clapham is actually on the inward flight path to Heathrow Airport or Gatwick Airport or whichever, and every single one of them was on the way to Terminal 3. We find other things to talk about as well, but when this king is on the throne, the air will be thick with incoming flights. Who do you think this one is? It's another foreign dignitary. It's a desert tribe come to bow down. Kings of Tarshish, of Sheba, of Seba. And there's another one stacked up behind, and then another one, and then another one. A royal party. Tribes from the desert. See the idea? And then in verses 12 to 14, we see that the king won't just be interested in the wealthy rulers. He won't simply be offering handouts to his financial supporters. Everyone will benefit from his perfect rule as he rescues the needy, the afflicted, the weak, the oppressed, the abused. Each one is precious. Verse 12, he'll deliver the needy who cry out, the afflicted who have no one to help. He'll take pity on the weak and the needy. And save the needy from death. He will rescue them. So now you may say to me, come on, William, this is just wishful thinking. I mean, the Israelites just had a secret longing for some kind of utopian dream. They can't really have been expecting something like this, can you? Well, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, you'll remember when we were looking at Matthew's Gospel and the genealogy, right at the beginning, we saw that this is exactly the kind of international ruler bringing worldwide blessing and peace that God had promised. And far from being a nationalistic and selfish prayer, this prayer is a response to God's promise to Abraham to break into his world and bring a leader through whom all nations would be blessed. And you can see that in verse 17 of the psalm. May his name endure forever, same idea, may it continue as long as the sun. All nations will be blessed through him, and they will call him blessed. That idea first stated to Abraham, now embodied in the king. And if we stop and think about it just for a minute or two, I think you'll agree that this longing that God will do what he's promised to do is the sort of thing that many of us, Christian or non-Christian, would love to see happen. I wonder if you're familiar with the American President Woodrow Wilson, who was the founder of the Covenant of Nations back at the beginning of this century. Now it's the United Nations. I bet if you went into the headquarters of the UN, you'd find people today with a high ambition for establishing some sort of new world order where there would be peace, justice, prosperity, righteousness. The New Agers in the late 20th century have the same kind of ideals. Just listen to this verse from John Lennon's Imagine. I won't sing it. Imagine all possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may think I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. See, there's not such a huge difference, is there, between the aspirations and longings of Woodrow Wilson and his Covenant Nations and the aspirations and longing of the age of Aquarius, the age of Yin, universal religion, one world economy, one world government. All comes from New Age ideas. And it would be wonderful, wouldn't it? We can't deny the dream to wake up and not find those kind of things in the tabloids. The trouble is, as we all know, that the promise, this national prayer for Israel, never came about. It was never fulfilled through any of the kings, because one after another, although they met with varying degrees of success, none of them ever managed to deliver. And the reason is that it was never realized, because just as they thought we're getting somewhere with any one of these plans, the whole apple cart is upset by our sinful greed or selfish pride or personal prejudice or self-interests. And that's where a second Old Testament passage comes in. Just flick forward, if you would, to page 746. A bit further down the storyline, 200 years later. Two prophets, both Micah and Isaiah, bring promises from God that he would still provide an international, just, pure and righteous figure to rule. So look at verse 20 of chapter 59, 746. The Redeemer will come to Zion, to those in Jacob who repent of their sins, declares the Lord. And then, chapter 60, arise, shine, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth and thick darkness is over the people. But the Lord rises upon you and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes and look about you. All assemble and come to you. And so on. Then look down to verse 6. Herds of camel will cover your land. Young camels of Midian and Ephah, and all from Sheba will come, bearing gold and incense, and proclaiming the praise of the Lord. And then Micah in chapter 5 again tells us that this figure will be born in Bethlehem, and that he will be born of a woman, that he will shepherd his flock, and that his greatness will reach the ends of the earth. So now let's press the pause button on the vid for a moment. Where have we got to? There's a promise of an international mighty king who will rule in purity forever over all people from all over the world. There's the promise of a mighty rescuer, redeemer, who will rescue from sin which over and over again topples and scuppers our best efforts at a new world order. Now take the pause button off for a second and turn to Matthew chapter 2. I've never been in an Olympic stadium. There's one event I would love to be there for, and it's the arrival of the marathon runners at the end of their 26 miles. Can you imagine what it must be like? Sense of expectation, anticipation. And then everybody rises to applause and jumps up and down as he starts out on his final lap. You see, as the Magi arrive at the end of their 500-mile journey from deep in the heart of modern-day Iraq, Matthew has got one clear message for us. Bursting through the archway of history and into the stadium of our universe, here is God's long-awaited King. He is the genuine article. This really is the beginning of the end of God's plan for his new world order. But interestingly, the message isn't the same as the Olympic Stadium. It's not stand up, wave, shout, cheer. The message is this. It's time to get down on your knees. And Matthew makes the point clearly in our text in a number of ways. He makes it in the contrast in verses 1 and 2 between the earthly king and the heavenly King Jesus. Just look at what the Magi say and how Matthew reports it. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. During the time of King Herod, the earthly king, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Not King Herod, but the King of the Jews. And then the contrast again, when King Herod, the earthly king, heard this, he was disturbed. Do you see what Matthew's done, interleaving the heavenly king with the earthly king and the Magi coming to worship the heavenly king? And then Matthew makes the point of his bursting onto the scene of history in verses 3 to 6 with that reference which we've alluded to just now from the Old Testament. That he is geographically authentic and has been born in Bethlehem, where it was always promised he would be born. And then Matthew makes the point again that this is God's long-awaited king by the action of the Magi in the narrative. Did you notice? No trouble is too great for them to find this baby. They engage in a 500-mile journey and meticulously search until they find him. No words are sufficient to express their joy in verse 10. Now, it's an interesting translation in verse 10. The literal translation runs like this. They rejoiced a joy great exceedingly. They were overjoyed. They rejoiced a joy great exceedingly. There's just no words sufficient to say it, is there? And you can see why the translator has such a difficulty. No trouble is too great, no words are sufficient, no cost is too high when they find him. They bring their most precious and wealthy goods and bow down and worship. Now, some of us here this evening, I guess, have got children ourselves. We probably think they're wonderful. But I can make a guess that not one of us has ever been tempted to even dream of getting down on our knees to worship them. Their grandmothers may have done. But even they usually stop short of getting down on their knees to the tiny baby. But these Magi, you see, have an inkling of what is going on in God's overall scheme of things. This child is born King of the Jews. We have come to worship. Not just an earthly king like King Herod, who can just be passed by on our way to see the real king. Not just a Charles or a William. He has been born King of the Jews, and therefore King of all nations. Now, do you see why Matthew includes the Magi in this brief 13 verses as they whisk in and whisk out again? This is, if you like, the first aeroplane coming in. In the language of Psalm 72, here is the first of the nations coming to bow down and worship, same language. In the language of Isaiah 60, here are the first of the tribes come to bring gifts of gold and incense to the king. In the language of Micah, here are the first of God's people from all nations come to recognize God's long-promised king. I want you to see that there is a huge difference between the claims of Jesus Christ and the hopes of John Lennon and Woodrow Wilson. See, this is no human plan or human solution or mere dream. The historical factual birth of the baby Jesus is part of a promise, a long promise made thousands of years before Jesus was born. It's a promise that began way back in Genesis to Abraham, that God would send this ruler who will bless all people. It's a promise that can be traced all the way through the years. This is no late 20th century reaction to the horrors of living in a global village, where there are all sorts of awful things going on. This is God's eternal plan to provide a rescuer and ruler. It's no ordinary baby. It's God's son, with no ordinary mission, as we saw last week. He is Jesus, who has come to rescue his people, verse 21, from their sins. And since the visit of the Magi, million upon million of people have come to bow before him. If you've been here Sunday by Sunday over this last year, I was just thinking earlier this week, the people we've seen from every nation coming to worship him, from Uganda, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Melbourne, Christchurch, Korea, Kazakhstan, the Czech Republic. This is just the beginning here in Matthew 2 of a huge plan that has begun way back, and that God has been keeping his promise that people from every nation will come in to worship. You see what Matthew is saying? Neither he nor Jesus say that this is the end of the plan. No, as we read on in the Gospel, we find Jesus telling us that he will return again when every person in the whole world will bow. But this is the beginning of the plan as the first nations come in to worship. And so it leaves us with one simple question. One simple point, one simple question. How will we respond to this king now? Do you notice Herod? Herod said that he wanted to worship, verse 7. Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship." Herod said he wanted to worship. But on Monday morning, when he got to the office, he changed his mind. The teachers of the law knew a vast amount about this king. I reckon the teachers of the law probably could have led one of our Read, Mark, Learn Bible studies without doing any preparation. They would have just sat down there and they would have known all the answers. But as the gospel goes on, we see that far from responding to Jesus' rule and bowing to him, they call out, "Crucify, crucify." But the Magi, no trouble is too great in their search. Not just 1 hour on a Sunday evening, once a week. They are determined to find him. And if you're here for the first time and you're not quite sure quite who Jesus is, well, won't you follow them and search after this king? For the Magi, no words are sufficient to express their absolute delight and joy when they find God's eternal ruler. They rejoiced a joy great exceedingly. And if you call yourself a Christian, is that what you think of this baby boy in this house in Bethlehem? When you think about him, do you think a joy great rejoicing exceedingly, that he is God's great eternal ruler who has come to bring righteous rule and rescue? And then when they found him, no cost was too high. Not just reaching in their pocket on a Sunday evening for a suitable tip, not just turning up once a week, but giving everything to him. Will you follow them? If you belong to Jesus, and bow down and worship him with all of your life. Well, we're going to have a moment now just to think of this Jesus, long promised God's King. And then we're going to sing a song which, if you'd like to join with us, the words are very powerful. All that I am, I lay before you. As we think of God's eternal plan to send a ruler whose rule will extend to all nations, it's appropriate that we ourselves bring ourselves before him and lay everything before him in worship. And I think we'll stay seated to sing it, but let's have a moment's quiet first, and then Simpo, if you play for us. Think of this Jesus who has been born King of the Jews. Think of his identity, long promised, God's ruler and God's rescuer. And let's model the response of the Magi, bringing our lives to him. Bowing down and worshipping him in great joy.